This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Northern Ireland, talks are about to begin about power sharing. Catholic and Protestant leaders from Northern Ireland, as well as political leaders from the Republic and England, are expected to participate. They will discuss Ireland's troubled relationship with Britain, the conflict between the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, and the possibility of uniting the North and the South into one republic. The talks were organized by Peter Brook, Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. My guest, Padraig O'Malley, is a journalist, scholar, and author of The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today, and Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. O'Malley is also senior policy analyst at the John W. McCormick Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He was born in Dublin. One group that was not invited to participate in the upcoming talks is Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. I asked O'Malley how representative these talks could be if Sinn Féin isn't represented.
Sinn Féin represents about one-third of the Catholic nationalist community. And the fear is, of course, that if agreement is reached between the parties in Northern Ireland and that any outcome might be destroyed by the activities of the IRA. And that is a problem. But again, I think the belief is that if the parties in Northern Ireland can reach some agreement among themselves, that is, the constitutional parties can reach some agreement among themselves, that the population at large will so welcome that resolution that support for the IRA will fall away, and that people would in fact be more anti-IRA than ever before.
What's the rationale for not including them?
There are two rationales. First is that the Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, endorses the use of violence. Both the Dublin government and the Irish government are firm in their belief that the IRA must renounce the use of violence, not just call a ceasefire, but renounce the use of violence if they are to have a place at the table. And secondly, it's been difficult enough to get these talks going. And if Sinn Féin had in fact renounced violence, the Unionist parties still wouldn't be agreeable to the Sinn Féin having a place at the table.
What's the most optimistic outcome of these talks? If they really were successful, what would the outcome be?
Successful talks would involve a government within Northern Ireland in which the Catholic minority would share power with the Protestant majority, and secondly, a relationship between the North of Ireland and the Republic that recognised that there is an Irish tradition within Northern Ireland and that expressed that Irish dimension.
If these talks were successful, do you think it would be the end of the conflict within Northern Ireland?
Well, yes and no. For the talks to be successful will require an end to the violence. So I don't think that one can talk about a successful outcome if, in fact, the violence continues, because it's likely that the violence will bring down any tenuous agreement that would be reached. On the other hand, at some point in the process, I think the IRA will have to be brought in. I don't believe that you can bring peace to Ireland without talking to all of the parties involved, and that includes the IRA. It may be moralistic not to do so, but it's not pragmatic politics.
At the end of your book on civil wars, you wrote that you thought it was unlikely that there would be any resolution in the conflict in Northern Ireland for another 20 or 30 years. Are you optimistic about these talks?
No, I'm not optimistic. I believe that the differences that exist not only between the Catholic Party, the SDLP, and the Protestant parties, the Official Unionist Party and the Democratic Unionist Party, are great, but that the differences between the Protestant parties themselves are great, and that there are still too many unresolved struggles within each community for there to be the possibility of consensus on the issues that are involved.
Do you think that Margaret Thatcher's departure and John Major being in is going to change the outlook for any resolution?
I mean, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Thatcher, because of her right-wing position and her stand in the Conservative Party, was able to sign an agreement with the Irish government in 1985 that a Labour government would not have been able to sign. In a sense, Mrs. Thatcher was to Northern Ireland what Richard Nixon was to China. The Northern Ireland is simply not an issue in British politics. It never surfaces as an election issue. And Northern British prime ministers only deal with the question of Northern Ireland when they're under a great deal of pressure to do so. And they rarely are under a great deal of pressure. So I wouldn't expect any change in Mr. Major's position. The British position, which is accepted by the Irish government, is that there will be no change in the constitutional status of Northern Ireland until a majority of the people of Northern Ireland wish there to be a change in that status. So as long as a majority of the people in Northern Ireland want to remain part of the United Kingdom, it is the position of the British government that they will have that right.
And the Protestants are the majority in Northern Ireland.
The Protestants are in a majority of 60% to 40%. So before you could have a majority of the people of Northern Ireland voting for the unification of Ireland, probably at least one Protestant in three would have to change his or her mind and opt to become part of the Republic of Ireland.
And you think that's unlikely?
I think that's very, very unlikely.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Padraig O'Malley. He's the author of Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. He also wrote The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Padraig O'Malley, who writes about the politics of Ireland. Now, your latest book is on the hunger strikes. You wrote an op-ed piece after the death of hunger striker Bobby Sands. And you wrote, there is no history now, just lies, distortion, and sham. And it is to this that the sad and awful death of Bobby Sands will add. He is myth now, part of an elaborately cultivated contrivance about the past, to conceal an ugliness about ourselves we the Irish dare not face. It is the Irish who are doing the damage to the Irish. We are our own oppressors. Why do you think the Irish are their own oppressors?
Well, because of the manner in which we have chosen to interpret our history. There are two great traditions in Ireland, the tradition of the constitutional and the tradition of the unconstitutional. The tradition of the constitutional has always put the emphasis on resolving the problem of the relationship between Britain and Ireland by resolving that problem by peaceful means, by parliamentary means. The tradition of the unconstitutional says, in effect, that you cannot resolve this problem by peaceful means. It must be resolved by violence. And for 120 years, these two traditions ran in parallel. And the vast gains made by the tradition of the constitutional in the 19th century in particular had the support of the majority of the people of Ireland. The unconstitutional tradition only popped up in uprisings in 1798, 1816, 1848, 1867, and 1916, all of which failed and all of which were supported by only a tiny minority of the people. Yet our history tells us that it was the tradition of the unconstitutional that actually brought freedom to Ireland in 1920. And all of our history is refracted through that prism. And youngsters in Ireland from the 1920s right through the 1980s, on both sides of the border, if they were Catholic, were taught that the people who took up a gun and went out to free Ireland were heroes. And as long as we make the tradition of violence heroic, as long as we continue to entertain the myths of heroic failure or self-sacrifice, there always will be youngsters, particularly in Northern Ireland, who will quite willingly join the IRA and die for what they think is the freedom of Ireland.
What are some of the examples that of the myths that you think a lot of politics in Northern Ireland are based on now? The myths that motivate people?
Well, the myth that motivates the Catholic community, or that section of the Catholic community which supports the IRA, is the myth that the only way to deal with the British is through the use of violence, that is what they understand. The second myth is that the partition of Ireland was brought about by Britain, engineered by Britain for its own selfish interests, and that if Britain were to withdraw from Northern Ireland, you would have miraculously a solution to the Irish question tomorrow morning. And the third myth is the myth of who we are. The Irish have defined themselves, or the Irish nationalists have defined themselves, in terms of an Irish Catholic tradition. That overlooks the fact that on the island of Ireland you have at least three separate traditions, not just the Gaelic Catholic tradition. You also have the Anglo-Protestant tradition, and you also have the Scots-Presbyterian tradition. And there is a plurality of cultures, yet the society of Irish nationalism has not found itself capable of accepting that heterogeneity of cultures.
I think our listeners at this point will really want to know what your background is in and how that figures into your perception of the politics there. Mm. It's an area where people are expected to be so partisan.
Well, I was born in Dublin, raised a Catholic in a non-political family. And while I was growing up, the issue of Northern Ireland was never an issue of any dominance in political discourse in Ireland. Irish governments simply called upon Britain periodically to withdraw from Northern Ireland. And that was that. No government ever developed a policy for trying to bring about the peaceful unification of the country. And in fact, it was not until I came to the United States that my interest in Northern Ireland began to grow, and I began to take a very serious attitude towards it after what is called Bloody Sunday in 1972. That was the occasion on which British paratroopers opened fire on civilians in a civil rights march in Derry and killed 14 people. What I find interesting in kind of looking at my own relationship to the question are two things. One thing I set out to explore in Biting at the Grave was where I stood in relationship to the violence. The question I had for myself being, if I had been born in Belfast, in West Belfast, in a deprived Catholic area of Belfast, would it be likely that I would have ended up joining the IRA? And I must confess that I think the answer is that I would have been likely to join the IRA. Young people who joined the IRA didn't start out as youngsters being believers in a United Ireland. They went through a number of very traumatic experiences in the late 60s and early 70s and found themselves in the IRA. And they then developed their political beliefs.
My guest is Padraig O'Malley. He's the author of The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today, and Biting at the Grave, The Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Padraig O'Malley, who writes about the politics of Northern Ireland. I want to get back to one of the myths that you mentioned, and that is if it weren't for England, then there could be a peaceful resolution to the problems in Northern mm-hmm. Ireland. You once wrote, "We need England. We need it to disguise the sordid and sad reality of our murderous designs on each other. We need an enemy." Is that the function you think Britain is playing? And even if Britain gave Northern Ireland its independence, that the conflicts would continue?
That's right. As long as we continue to blame England or Britain for our problems, then we don't have to confront the truth about ourselves. And the truth is that on the island of Ireland, you have two communities, each of which claims allegiance to a different tradition. The Protestants in Northern Ireland to the United Kingdom, and the Catholics on the island of Ireland to a unified Ireland. And unless we recognize those differences as being real and stop blaming Britain for them, then there can be no resolution. Because in effect, the hardcore nationalist position would be that the Protestants of Northern Ireland are somehow brainwashed Englishmen, and that all you have to do is to have the British leave, and in a couple of months or a very short space of time, the Protestants of Northern Ireland will find, lo and behold, that they are in fact Irish. They'll kind of rediscover their Irishness. So we are intent not on accommodating difference, but on kind of submerging another culture into our own in an attempt to reproduce one homogenous culture.
You seem to think that the politics of martyrdom really get in the way in Northern Ireland. For instance, when you were writing your book on the hunger strikers, you went to visit the parents of the hunger strikers who died. And you wrote that there seemed to be no way that you could write about the hunger strikers without hurting their families, because you wanted to dissect conventional wisdom and the families wanted to embrace it. Can I get you to elaborate on that? Because I think that gets to the essence of the kind of problem that you're talking about.
I must say that visiting these families was one of the most moving experiences of my life. But in two or three cases where there was a brother or a sister of the dead hunger striker who was married and who had children, I would talk to the children about their dead uncle. And invariably I would point to a photograph of the dead hunger striker, which always occupied the pride of place in every home, and ask a child, "Who is that?" And on every occasion, the child would answer, "That was my uncle Sean," or "That was my uncle Raymond," or "That was my uncle Patsy, who died." And I would say, "What did he die for?" And the child would say, "He was a soldier. He died to save or to free Ireland." And right there, we have the problem, because the myth is being transferred even at that point from one generation to the next. You have a generation of young people who will grow up regarding the dead hunger strikers as heroes, as martyrs, and who will seek to emulate their lives.
Why don't you think they were heroes and martyrs?
I don't think they were, well, let me qualify that. My relationship to the hunger strikes was that I was both repelled by what the hunger strikers did and attracted by what the hunger strikers did. I was repelled by the easy sentimentality that Irish people often use with regard to issues of life and death. I was repelled by the easy disposal of life, the willingness to die for Ireland rather than to live for it. I was attracted by the heroic quality, by the fact that these were young men who were prepared to lay down their lives in a very long and agonizing way in order to stand up for their beliefs. I find their beliefs to be founded on historical inaccuracy. I find their beliefs to be narrow, not to embrace the traditions or culture of the Irish people as a whole. And I find the truths, the received truths they have inherited to be essentially false.
I want to get back to the talks that are about to begin in Northern Ireland. You've expressed your pessimism about those talks. What makes you hopeful? Do you have any reason for hope to resolution of the conflict?
At the present point, I don't really. I believe Ireland is one of those conflicts that is best described in the following way, that the tendency to think in terms of solutions aggravates the problem itself, and that we should not so much look for quote-unquote solutions, but we should look to build a series of structures or processes that over time will facilitate the reconciliation of the two peoples of Ireland, the Catholic people of Ireland and the Protestant people of Ireland.
What kind of process would help reach a reconciliation?
Well, any process that makes the two communities more integrated. The most obvious thing is, of course, integrated education. At the moment, Catholics go to Catholic schools, Protestants go to Protestant schools. Each tradition learns its own version of history. Each sees the other in terms of a stereotype. So the obvious first step would be to develop an integrated system of education. And I must add that one of the major obstacles to that is the Catholic Church, which, of course, insists on having its own schools and is not at all interested in integrated education.
Padraig O'Malley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Padraig O'Malley is a senior policy analyst at the John W. McCormick Institute at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His latest book is Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. I'm Terry Gross.